Of course, Outlook has been a big part of our work. And so already, thank you so much for all your help, you know, and facilitating us getting a copy of the publication and everything.
No, it's wonderful that you're interested in this project, which also was very, very special for me and my team and, my beginnings here.
Yeah, and we did get to meet Carmen. We talked to her on, which was so cool, about, you know, really some of the, like, technical minutiae of producing the maps and the box and everything.
Yeah. She was a perfect match for the project.
Yeah, and one thing we're really finding, and I guess maybe you had this experience, is so much of Asher's work is actually embedded in the interpersonal collaborations with organizers. Like, I'm sure you and Carmen, and the way he worked so precisely and complexly, but also very beautifully with institutions and institutional leaders. So it's been so illuminating to actually talk to people that made these projects happen with him.
Yeah. But I remember that many people asked me afterwards how it was working with him, how difficult it was. It wasn't difficult at all. But I know that many other institutions have had a lot of difficulties working with someone going so deep into details. And
he'll sometimes find these points, right?
I just got the old file here with all the mails and letters by Michael, and that was really interesting.
Wow.
How it started, my first letter to him and his answer, and it was pre-email time, at least for him.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how the project came about. Did you know Asher previously, or maybe about his proposal?
I knew his work. I never met him. But he was, when I was studying in Lüneburg, I really was into his work. And then I started working here and kind of tried to give this whole landscape, land art projects, new aspects and impulses, mainly with younger artists. But I just took the opportunity to invite him. And it was a project with 8 commissions for site-specific outdoor sculptures, and where they're meant to be really sculptural things. And I knew this wouldn't happen inviting Michael, but I wanted to have this kind of conceptual approach to the project. And it was also quite for some of the other artists who were involved, like Embry and Druckset and so on, who met him here. Quite challenging, knowing that he's in the project, and I just took the opportunity to do something might not be possible in a normal situation at that time here. But I had a budget. I could invite international artists and work with them. Yeah,
it's so interesting. I think Outlook's one of the most astonishing projects, you know, and it kind of tethers so many strands in his work, like works that address public utility, works that address how infrastructures touch people, works that reveal invisible systems, and then works where, like, a publication shows you something that's implicit but not known. But then one thing I was thinking a lot about, of course, is this relationship to landscape. And there's some funny notes in his archive about a kind of real disdain for, like, landscape photography and maybe like aesthetic experiences in art that address transcendence or these kind of like cliche ideas around natural space not being natural. And then you see that in many projects, he kind of addresses these things. But I feel like this is a kind of culmination of a lot of those thoughts that you know, like he did a project in Sonbeek,
yeah,
where it was with these little plaques showing the name of camera parts, and he put them on tree stumps so that you were all of a sudden in this weird apparatus about your own desire to, like, image a landscape through a technological system. But Outlook seems to extend these, it sort of beautifully encapsulate many aspects of his thinking.
Yes, and I wanted to have this kind of non-romantic approach to this landscape, which is so well known from poems and films and so on, and so loaded with cliches. Well, we could talk a lot about romanticism and conceptual art, which has more in common than one might think. But yeah, at this point, that was...
Yeah. We actually found one roll of 24 shots of photos of the landscape that were like site visit photos.
Oh, okay.
Which are actually taken by Asher, and they're really romantic.
Yeah, they almost perform the cliche. And I remember you were saying you weren't so certain that these something like this existed, but the archive, they dug deeper and they found a roll of conventional 35 millimeter film, and it's pictures of trees, pictures of snow, pictures of buildings and landscape.
Yeah.
Expanses of land, like sunset. And then he's written on the back exactly like where it is. And it looks like maybe a site visit over 2 days and it snowed maybe at some point. So there's...
We had snow, yeah.
Half with snow, half without. And they're kind of the perfect corollary to the reality presented by the project. And then the foundation said that they saw in notes, when he would show his friends the Outlook project, he'd show them maps and then he would sometimes show them these snapshots.
Oh, yeah.
To give them this kind of like... I guess sort of like the hybridity that was achieved when you went there and saw it, like this romantic, beautiful landscape and then this other view, you know, so.
I found some photos of the landscape which I took at that time, and I found one of my first facts or letters to him where I refer to some pictures which I sent him about the landscape here.
I wonder if these are your photos, because they're pretty nicely taken.
No, my photos are very bad, actually. I have them here. They are too dark. The weather was gray. It was January. They look very depressing.
Yeah, he must have taken these because he has the negatives too. So the ones that in the archive must, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So let's see. Yeah, still already some infrastructures in it, or just a field. In winter.
Yeah, his notably don't show any markers of infrastructure. They're just completely like pastoral landscapes.
And I remember that when he was here, we were like following three fields of investigation. One was about the infrastructure, energy, da da da. Then I remember he did some research or was interested in machines. Especially machines farmers kind of build themselves or modify custom-made machines, modify it fits more better with their kind of needs. So, and then somehow I found he was looking for empty barns and houses, and I found out that we put it advertised in a local newspaper that we are looking for abandoned barns, empty storages and so on with our telephone number. That was the third field. Yeah, and then in general we did a lot of research on the history of this landscape. And I remember we have been had a tour with a biologist around the nature park who told us everything about the transformation and cultivation of this landscape. And that was a very beautiful day. So maybe he took the pictures on that occasion.
Yeah, and that, you know, there was that interesting like landscape always having marks of its own transformation seems deep in his work. And you know, John Knight, who's a friend of ours, told us about another project that never was realized for Storm King, mm-hmm. where Asher was inventorying every piece of plant life on the whole property in a completely indexical way and was going to begin to make a project that dealt with the entire, say, glossary of living material on the Storm King property or something. So, yeah, that these things are, I mean, it's so true in all his work that nothing's natural. Everything is touched and changed and sort of bears history and all. So that makes so much sense. And how did it come that you all decided to move forward with this one project around power and infrastructure?
That was his proposal then, after doing the research. And I think he kind of had this general ideas, but this was, I think we didn't get so much response about barns and empty spaces. And then also this transformation of machines somehow was a bit of a dead end. Maybe he had something in mind which then didn't. I think the research on the history of landscape and so on, which is really interesting here, was something he was just also interested in general. But at a very early stage, he asked us to investigate on the infrastructure.
And then what was the process like getting these maps? Because I think in a lot of cases with his work, there is this transformational moment where he seems to pull off the impossible or something. So like, you know, the fact that you could, you know, receive and duplicate and make available the entire like power grid of your area, it's no small feat.
In the beginning, he said he would come in early 2003, but he can't promise that he'll come up with a proposal or might fail. He would just come for some kind of research and said, I'm fine with that, no problem. Well, first we figured out what kind of networks, energy structures are there. It was also, I think that was a theoretical, or we decided first to go for gas, electricity, and water. So the basic things. I think we might have discussed telecommunication, but then we thought this is like, one doesn't fit into the others, more on this civilization, heating, ecological energy approach at that time. And I did some research. I I still have my notes. Did the research, called lots of people. Who is responsible for that? Yeah, telecommunication, yeah, electricity, water. And then we also thought about water coming in and going out of the houses, which we also dropped. So we just have the water supply for the houses. And then I just made a lot of phone calls, asking people, and then I wrote polite letters describing what we are interested in, and then Michael and I visited the responsible people. Yeah.
How hard was it to obtain that information? And was there like any pushback on revealing that information on the part of those responsible?
We expected having difficulties, especially because short time before, in the US, there were these anthrax attacks, and people were very, or became aware that how fragile these structures are. So we kind of expected to have difficulties, but actually it wasn't. I remember when we came to in Rothenburg at the water, whatever, in his office, they liked so much that someone was interested in what they do, which is normally behind the scenes, that they gave us all the information and I got official permission to use and to publish them. I wrote that it's just for an art project and it's small scale in a way. That was no problem at all. And the when you look at the maps of the electricity things, they printed them for us.
Oh, so the electric company made those maps for you?
Yes, they made them for us. They were the most digitalized. So there we could tell them we need this part in that measurements and so on. So they could just, they printed them for us.
Wow, we did not know that fact at all.
When you look at it, it has a kind of different kind of paper and so on. It's
right.
It was all made on their printer.
Wow. And then maybe could you talk a little bit about the design of the actual object Like, I know it's a very specific design that Asher came up with and complicated to print, but maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I try to remember how it was. I mean, a friend of us, a graphic designer, made the design of the, made the layout and so on. And then we thought a lot about how to present these maps. It was kind of step by step. We made several proposals. And then somehow we decided, or made proposals to Michael, and Carmen was pretty much into it, finding this out and making proposals to Michael. And then they discussed it and she put photos online so he could see how it looks and so on. And then, yeah, I think first was just to have a custom made kind of cover for it. Which the also these companies use in their office, or everybody in Germany used this kind of envelopes, plastic envelopes in the office. It was something we just ordered somewhere, I don't know. And so like any worker of them could store the maps. And then there was the idea, yeah, to make this kind of, them. It was quite difficult to decide how to make the box. And then I don't know who came up with the idea making it like this, which is very simple, but this is also a bit unusual, but when you can see what's inside.
Yeah, that they stick out the top like that, yeah.
Yeah, that they stick out, and but you can put them easily in a shelf as well. I don't know whose idea it was. It was a whole process of making proposals to Michael, and he looked at it and said what he liked, what he didn't like. Yeah, I remember once we discussed whether we should put gas, water, electricity also out here on here, but then he decided no, just to keep the coordinates and not having something on the, not making like a book, more like an object or, yeah.
Of course, because he would think a lot about it if it was a book, and it's certainly not.
Yeah, it's not a book. But that also was a process. I think in the beginning, everybody was thinking more like a book. And then we had these huge maps, and to say, how do we fold them? How do we handle them? Do we make them, for example, the electricity company, they have them, had them already digitalized. So we kind of materialized them in that way. Of course, they print them when they need them, but normally they don't. But in the water, they still had very, very old-fashioned maps on pergament, this old-fashioned semi-transparent papers. And when they changed something, they really took a knife and scratched it away and repainted. They were planning to digitalize these maps at that point, but they're still using the old ones. It was just, how can we handle this? And how do we make them, choose scales to make them comparable to each other? Going from the huge, big choice of many options to something which makes it manageable and comparable.
Yeah, in his archive, there's a lot of drawings about the cardstock, the cardboard cover.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, one thing that we see in his work is kind of a deep interest and fascination with graphic design and typographical layout. And so there's lots of shaky handwritten drawings of different cover designs with the coordinates moving different ways, or some even set outlook, or different kind of treatment, like you say, and then scaling. And then there was one design that had squares of different size that was maybe also indicating like how the maps zoom in on locations, show relative scale within the area demarcated by the project.
Yeah, that was a process of decisions, discussions between him and Carmen and me, and how to zoom in and out. And I remember also, because we have these signs here and so on, and then the decision to really draw, make this by hand, the colors, the coloring, because they were done by hand in the maps. And it was somehow, the decision was to make it like this.
It's astonishing the depth of collaboration, because I know when we got our copy, you know, and actually when we saw it in the archive too, we opened it up, and then it's clear you almost don't believe it that everyone is hand highlighted. that your team went in and like hand worked, and you made 1,000 copies, right, or something, some large amount, right?
Not 1,000, 200.
200, but that's still quite a lot of work to make.
Yeah.
Hand color 200 copies.
Yeah, Wiebke at that time and Carmen, they were very dedicated.
She described to us many hour-long phone calls she had with Asher.
Yeah.
Sort of going over all the details. And she said it was very, very difficult, but incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, he came up with a proposal when he already had left, or it was his last day. So the actual process of started when he was gone. And I found faxes by him apologizing that he woke up Carmen in the middle of the night. Things like that.
I mean, one of the many things that's astonishing about this project is it's one of a very few, in the presentation we make at Artist Space, there's only two projects where he actually made something for sale. And that actually the public making a transaction or a purchase was the kind of receptive gesture that activated the work. And the other one was in 1979 in Groningen. He also made a work around utility where he opened, maybe you know this project, he had a farmer's market stand in the town square, and you could go there and get your home phone number printed down the front of a t-shirt.
Ah, great. Yeah.
So you would go and pay this small price, and then your number would be customized down in black sans serif letters. This utility became linked to you in a kind of stylistic way, but it involved a purchase of a good. And the, you know, the lore and the some of the infamy of Asher is around non-transaction and non-exchange. So, of course, when he addresses exchange, it's hyper-specific in particular. But maybe, I guess, we'd be curious a little bit about this decision that something could actually be made for sale and how it then hit the public, the availability, and maybe how that went.
I don't remember. I think maybe it's because at the first step he looked at it as a like a publication, and then it's clear that you sell it, but then more and more it became an object in a way, or so we never questioned that, but we discussed that we'll not treat it like a rare object of art. Not like an artist edition or whatever. It's not signed. All the marks which are handmade are by us, not by Michael. And then it was clear that we would sell it not even like a, if it would have been a publication or a book, even cheaper, but it was more how much would someone here in the village would pay for it. If he wants, or if he wants to know, where are the pipes here? What is it? That was the decision of having it for such a small amount of money. So like, it's not a big decision, and you don't pay for it like a collector's item. And we never discussed to sell it for a higher price elsewhere. So that's up to anybody. Yeah. And so we also, as this was kind of a also conceptual decision, we never changed the price until it's nearly sold out.
Yeah. Again, unlike many of his projects, it's also really interesting the duration, because, you know, there would be works like when he made the publication for MoMA, the Museum as Muse, it was available at MoMA for the duration of the exhibition, or the t-shirt project was available as a transaction for the duration of the stand. But this one, I mean, maybe it has to do with a lot of conditions, but I mean, was kind of been available for 20 years. I mean, that's really actually totally astonishing for his work to have something that addresses that kind of quiet duration.
And we were able to acquire one basically at the same price that it was originally sold for.
What we also had was very important to him, that for the like first 2 years, we had all the maps out on the wall outside, so everybody could come by and take a look. And I told you the story about the mayor who came when we had this electrical problem in the village, when he came to us on a Sunday morning to ask for the maps. And
maybe you can tell it again.
The mayor of our village at that time was an electrician and had his own company. One morning I was sitting in the garden. I'm living nearby the art institution. And he just came by and said, "Oh, don't you have these maps here?" Because he knew the project. He was on at the opening and so on. "We having some electrical problem in the village, and can I have a look at the maps to see where the problem might come from?" And so it was no problem. He could give him the maps and he could fix it.
Well, that's so good. Yeah, and we didn't realize until you just said now, because, you know, on your website and in the archive are these photos of the maps basically like pasted to the side of the building. And was that, and we didn't know that's for 2 years, but was that kind of, did you decide the layout and kind of the how those were put on the wall, or was that with Michael?
We just did it. Yeah, it was not a real layout decision. It was more like the size of the wall and how to, yeah, I think I have this picture. Yeah, just one next to the other, just like a, it's a very long wooden wall. And you see all these white marks? That's because this building is, this barn was used as an exhibition building since the mid-60s. And that's where normally all the posters you get from other institutions are hanging on the wall. And then you just remove them and these little white leftovers just stay there. That's how this wall looks a bit strange. And so we just put it in the right order in a horizontal line.
Oh, that's cool. So it's a bit already like a public display poster promotional wall.
Yeah. And you see it when you come down the road. Yeah. So people would be kind of irritated because normally there would be a poster of a museum or whatever. And then for... I think like 2 years, there was something completely different.
Was your audience that purchased them mostly local or also like international art world?
International art world. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And now are you sold out of them?
Nearly. Yeah.
Nearly. Yeah. So we're going to end up promoting it. So hope you don't get flooded when people see it here.
True.
We don't sell them anymore. Because these are the ones which we would like to keep in our archive. It's just a handful. As they are not available anymore, maybe the price goes up.
It's really interesting to think about this sort of dual function of the catalog as having this aesthetic appeal that appeals to people in the art world, for instance, and makes it valuable in that sense, but also just having this extremely functional use. The story of the mayor is very emblematic of that. And the design itself lends to its functionality because it's kind of like a portfolio. You could take it apart, you could take out the maps, and you could go where they're referring to and really study it. But it's just, yeah, I don't know, this tension between its non-functionality and its extreme functionality, I think, is really interesting and also appears a lot in Asher's work. Maybe you could, if he ever said anything about that, like the literal use value of it or in contrast to it being a really beautiful aesthetic object too.
Well, for him, it was kind of important to make these maps accessible. Yeah, that's also because of the low price and having a display outside. To give people like an awareness of where it's all coming from and making them also readable, giving all the explanation, all the signs, all the technical stuff, translating them into, that took a lot of time. And we had to ask the institutions a lot, what does this sign mean and that mean and so on. Yeah, that was quite important to him. I mean, we didn't do anything about the design of the maps themselves. That's the core of it. And we just, it's a ready-made. Like, of course, he was obsessed with what kind of paper do we use? How strong should the cardboard be? How do we use color? Do we do black and white? Or do we use the colors and so on? That was discussed. but not kind of questioned in the way you do as yeah.
Yeah, and as you say, the legend itself seems like such an achievement to not only, you know, as you just said, this is a really, really interesting deployment of the idea of a ready-made, which as Stella, I think, was alluding to, is like we see in his work how specifically he deploys that strategy and to such specific and very unexpected aims, but then also the thoroughness with which that legend was a work of translation, I guess, and a work of a public interface.
It was a lot of, about translation. Translation, this expert language. I mean, still, you have all these technical terms here, but at least it translates from a sign into language.
And I think you guys produced, there's maybe faxes from the institution to him where there was like English translation, so he could share it with non-German speaking audience. So we have access to those.
Oh yeah, great. Yeah, I don't remember that because this is all in German. Yeah, which also means that of course we could have translated all this. It also shows that it's more addressed to the local people here as an idea in a way. Otherwise, of course, we could made it legend and translate it into English.
Wow, what an amazing, just like an amazing undertaking. Yeah, it's interesting you spoke about the anthrax, the fear around revealing, the fragility of infrastructure, because he did, basically we see in his notes, he mailed a few copies to friends, like Fred Lean, the art historian in Brussels, or Anne Goldstein and Christopher Williams. And I think in the note to Fred, he mentioned September 11th, which was yesterday, that the American experience would lead one to believe quite the opposite about making anything around fragile infrastructures more visible or visible at all.
Yeah.
And you probably, even at that time, couldn't do a project like this at all because everything was so securitized and there was a lot of fear around revealing hidden structural systems. It's interesting that he then wanted to do it somewhere that was unfamiliar and it was more possible.
Yeah, but I remember that he and myself, we were surprised how easy it was, or how companies, I mean, they are public, and somehow it was no question that we have the right to see this and to ask for it. And maybe it's because it's in the countryside here and not people don't feel being part of a critical structure.
Yeah, and it does just, I mean, this is the obvious thing, almost like we said at the beginning, it does just, the citing it there is so interesting in relation to landscape and public art and monument and what's there, what's added, like all these questions around how art functions outside institutions is kind of also in this project. I mean, we learn this with Asher in general, like every work, the more you think and read and study the particularities of the way the work was made, the more the work takes meaning and the more complex the meaning becomes. And this is certainly one of those projects.
Yeah.
I wonder how much those systems have been updated, if there's still even a relationship to the maps that Asher used at the time, or if it's completely different. It'd be interesting to look at the public utility maps now.
Yeah, I have no idea how they, I mean, now they're all digitalized. Somehow we also felt like coming at the right moment from these handmade maps, which are carefully changed and modified over years, really having a smell from old paper and these old-fashioned. It was very impressive to meet the guy there in this of the Wasserwerk, the water, or whatever that is in English. And he was so happy that we were so interested in what he's doing and all that meant. And whether it was an artist or not, it was just, these people also who work with these maps and these archives are also so hidden in a way. And they really liked being taken so serious. And
that adds a whole nother layer, thinking about it as like a portrait of labor and of other people as well, like a real portrait of a social configuration, you know, of roles and maintenance and access and things. That's really...
And yeah. One aspect which we learned during the project is that normally you think of a landscape of an area in terms of political borders, or but all these, this is completely different. Like the water is more still following natural or very ground structures, and so the center for the distribution of water is in another district, not here, which is has nothing to do with the political where the borders of the villages are, or the town halls, where, how the administration and the political structure is. That was also interesting for us to find out, no, we don't have to go to the next bigger town. We have to go somewhere southwest from here, because somehow the system adapts more in that direction. Same with gas and electricity.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, so basically it draws another set of borders, or like, that's not political.
Yeah, it's another kind of mapping.
Yeah. It's not about land ownership. It's not about sort of like political or like governmental structure. It's like another whole mapping system. Yeah. Are there other parts of this project we didn't ask you about? Or do you feel like we've covered a lot of it?
I think you covered a lot. Yeah.
It's so nice. Yeah, what a pleasure. We've been so excited to talk to you.
I just going through the things. This is...
Did he ever say anything about how he felt about the end result of the project?
Well, it was finished. He was happy with it. We sent it to him. I didn't hear anything else. And he was so dedicated to it for a month. So he was pretty much in it. Yeah. Oh, look. What I just found, which he sent us letter sets.
Oh, we didn't see these. That's not something.
These are examples about how deep he was into the graphic decisions on letters and types and fonts and so on. He cared a lot about that.
Yeah, we see that in this show we do, that becomes a theme. His specificity around, typographical design, basically. Oh, and then maybe one last question. The decision of how he participates in the Outlook exhibition catalog, it's pretty simple, right? There's the text written by, is the person called Dirk? And then there's photographic documentation of the maps on the side of the building.
Yes, yeah. That was simply it. We didn't want to reproduce anything in the catalog, which is this here. So we decided just to make it like that. Yeah,
that's really nice. Yeah, we have a few copies of that book too, so we've been of course reading, and Dirk's essay is really great.
He died recently, but he was really a very good friend, and someone we miss pretty much over here in the art world. Yeah.
Can I ask maybe like a zoom out question? Obviously, for you to invite Michael Asher so early in your time there, how much do these more conceptual critical art practices touch Springhornhof? I mean, it seems like that's a bit your legacy, is to bring artists like that to where you are.
From my understanding, it's very important, but normally we work with quite young artists and younger generations. But we also include this perspective on the development of what is public space, and like we did this project this year with Lisa Lefebvre was here to on modernism and modernist sculptures and so on. So sometimes we kind of go back and forth, but normally our program is much more dedicated to very contemporary artists of younger generations. But somehow at that point in 2003, I felt when I came here that these conceptual aspects were missing a bit. It was very sculptural, very much into proportions and whatever, and material and so on. So it, for me, it was kind of introducing a missing link to the whole institution, yeah.
And is it a mix of temporary projects and permanent projects?
Yes, we do have temporary exhibitions and do temporary projects, but we also have like about 40 to 50 permanent outdoor installations, sculptures, interventions in the open landscape, which people can explore by bike or whatever. And the earliest ones are from the mid-70s. And so step by step, it's growing or changing. And yeah. So in the latest are like by Mark Dyan or Niels Norman, artists like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was super informative.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for discovering this.
Of course. It's really an important part of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it was kind of like a breakthrough work in a lot of ways because, you know, we entered this dialogue with the foundation with a big question, is there even a show to be done? Because his work is so ephemeral. And I think things like this project gave clues that you can manifest certain parts of his work through material traces and actually uphold his rigor. And maybe actually this project was like a really important gateway in that whole direction, you know?
It also encompasses maybe our largest display.
Yeah, kind of by far. Yeah, yeah.
You can really spread it out.
Which is not typical of anything else really in the show. It's, everything is kind of condensed, it's small, but this is expansive.
Oh, Bettina, thank you so much.